King Arthur and Guinevere and Lancelot.
As you do?
Yeah, you know, like the Round Table. Grade 6, I wrote this play, and they put it on in the gym at the school. And then, you know, I was hooked.
That's
and,
awesome.
Could just continue to write stories and things, and then went to journalism school at what is now TMU with Van Ryerson, and became a newspaper reporter, wrote some fiction, and here I am now, full-time book author.
Yeah, which is pretty cool. How long ago did you stop with the full-time journalism?
I left the Globe in June of 2022. It was a hard decision, but something, you know, I'd been thinking about for a while. I'd just been doing it for a long, long time, and, you know, COVID made a lot of us rethink our priorities, I think, and it just was the right time for me.
I find it fascinating, too, the way that sometimes you can have a craft or a skill or whatever you want to call it that you use all the time in one context, and when you start using it in a different context, i.e. going journalism, writing columns, writing fiction, it just sort of, it really changes the way you think about what you do and the possibilities that you have.
Yeah, I kind of feel reborn, I have to say, like without having to have a facelift or anything or, you know, buy a Porsche, which I can't afford anyway. It really, like even, it makes you think that, yeah, even kind of small tweaks in your life can open up whole new landscapes that give you a fresh perspective and kind of new energy, too.
Absolutely. It's absolutely true. Now, sort of on the flip side of that, what you talk about in your new book is something you've actually been talking about for quite some time, obviously. This is a book about gender equity and issues that have been facing women forever, unfortunately. And you talk a little bit about what's changed, and we'll talk about some of the positive takeaways, of which there are plenty. But what was it that made you want to take this sort of these issues, which you have talked about for a long time, and fashion it into this format, this book of essays?
I think it was this idea that we are not as close to gender parity as we think we are. And in fact, in many parts of the world, including the United States, women's rights and the rights of non-binary and trans people as well are being rolled back at an alarming rate. And I felt that somebody had to kind of connect the dots, showing how all of these things are connected. And I wanted to do it through the lens of my own personal history and the reporting I'd done over the years, and do it in a way, as you say, that had kind of humor and heart and provided hope as well.
And it's important because as much as you need to talk about how bad things are and how dire things are and how important it is that we fight against these things, people do tend to just come away a little dispirited if you leave out the hope part.
Yeah, 100%. People really do want to hear, first of all, that change is being made in the world, and second of all, how they can make change in their lives if they feel that that is something that's important for them. And I really do feel that, like, the vast majority of people are excellent and they do such good work, but it's usually kind of under the surface and you have to look for it. They do it quietly in their jobs or in their communities or in volunteering or in their homes looking after, you know, perhaps like an ill relative or something like that. So there's so much good work being done. We just have to kind of try to highlight it.
Absolutely. And because it's funny, because there will be good work being done and suddenly the zeitgeist will kind of be that work. And then it's sort of like, seems like it's gone again. But of course it's not. And I'm thinking too, like, of the first essay, The Price of Silence, which is about the Me Too movement. And it was everywhere. And everyone was talking about it, male, female, and beyond gender, talking about this thing. And then you could say, nowadays, people might be like, isn't that over? Like, is that even still a thing? And of course, it's not at all.
Not only not at all, in fact, we only have to look at some of the high-profile cases going on around the world today to know that, no, this is not a thing in the past at all. Peter Nygaard, of course, just recently sentenced mm-hmm. to prison for a variety of sexual assaults. In the States, we have, you know, Diddy, who is in jail right now, awaiting charges of sex trafficking and other charges. Mm-hmm. This is so not behind us. It is. We are really still in the midst of it because change takes a long time to happen, as we understand. And the other interesting thing about the Me Too movement, and it's partly why I wrote the book, is because we've actually seen a backlash to women's rights mm-hmm. because of the Me Too movement. And so some of the kind of the rise of the manosphere that we're seeing, for example, or the rolling back of women's rights in the United States, a lot of social scientists tie that directly to kind of anger about Me Too, as if, you know, this call for justice overstepped itself when I don't think it even went far enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with that. And it's alarming to see the backlash because I guess when I was younger and more naive, but I don't even mean like a kid, I mean even 10 years ago, when I was younger and more naive, I always felt like, you know, my generation doesn't think all these silly conservative things. We don't have these notions. We're going to fix it. And then, of course, it didn't. And then I think, oh, my son's generation, they don't seem to. And yet I'm seeing young people following Andrew Tate and, you know, that kind of garbage. And
yeah,
it's just, I mean, not that you have an answer about what drives society in these directions, but what do you think it is? Is it just backlash? Does it diminish over time? Is it just a slow but measurable progress, do you think?
Well, you know, I do believe what Martin Luther King said, that the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice.
Right.
I totally do believe that. It takes a very long time, however. And, you know, backlash has always been with us. Susan Faludi wrote her book, Backlash, in 1991, and it documented the ongoing backlash, you know, over the past century, of how every time women's rights took a step forward, there was immediately like a snap back in reaction to that, mm-hmm. which made things in some ways even worse. And we are dealing with the fact that we live in a society in which there is an invisible scaffold called the patriarchy. We call it the patriarchy, that dates back millennia. And it's not the fault of individual men who exist within it, but it exists to benefit, support, and enhance the rights and privileges of one gender
right.
over another gender. And it's, again, it's not individuals necessarily. It's the systems that have been in place forever, and we kind of take them as natural, but they aren't natural. They haven't always been that way. If you go back a little bit further, you'll see that there was a more equitable society. And so we can, if we dismantle these invisible structures, I think move towards an more equitable society for all genders.
It's just, I guess people just think, how do I begin to do that? How do you begin to I mean, it seems so big, doesn't it? I mean, it's the world. And I guess it's so important for us to all do, you know, regardless of gender, for all of us to do our little tiny bits. Dismantling doesn't necessarily mean you have to Fight Club style, blow up all the buildings. although it can mean that. I'm not advocating. I'm just saying. But I mean, it really is in our little ways. And I guess paying it forward, getting other people to join us in that fight as well is super important too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is difficult, right? Because the problem seems so intractable. It's kind of like climate change. Like, where do I even begin? But you can begin, I always tell people, with the tiniest little steps. And I would think, you know, think to yourself, what am I? Am I a talker? Am I a doer? Am I a writer of letters? Am I a joiner? And then take your strengths and use them. If you're a talker, have a conversation with somebody about something you see that seems unfair to you. If you're a joiner, you know, volunteer at for a group or join a protest or something like that. I am myself a huge protest goer. the important thing is, I think, to overcome this kind of internalized suppression of our voices. Women mm-hmm. in particular feel this, like, oh, I can't speak up, and you know, people will think I'm obnoxious, they'll think I'm whiny, they'll think I'm asking for too much. And then when you find out, when you do speak up, even if it's just occasionally having a conversation with a friend or your partner or your kids, it feels very liberating. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards you think, oh, why was I afraid to say anything all along? You know, like a rock didn't fall out of the sky and like crush my head because I spoke up. And then you find other people's voices are raised alongside yours, and you start to have conversations. And conversations are how are the beginning of change, you know, face-to-face conversations, I would say. They're harder to do on social media sometimes because people are, you know, social media favors very extreme emotions.
It does,
and favors anger, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
So if you can't have a face-to-face conversation, I'd say that's the place to start.
Yeah, I would agree with you, too. It's just social media, well, I guess it's fine, and I use it plenty, but yeah, it's a weird place to try to have these conversations. One of the things
you can find allies, though, it's a good place for that. You know,
that's
find
true.
People and groups and research and information. So I am very down on social media, I have to say, because I think it's the root cause of a lot of our ills right now.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, obviously, it also has a good side, and it allows people to find other people whose opinions might inspire them, and it allows you to kind of do research, as long as your research doesn't just consist of like memes sent to you by your Uncle Stanley.
Exactly. No, I agree with you on the positives and negatives 100%, actually. I think that's absolutely true. Another thing you do in this book that I liked a lot is that you discuss the big topics that people would hope would be in there, and you talk about bodily autonomy, we talk about wage gap, we talk about Me Too. But there are a few other things in there that I think people don't think about. I know that once I started reading, for example, is the second chapter I'm thinking of, right? I think. Who Cares? Is that your second chapter?
Yeah.
Okay. And it's about caregiving. And, you know, it's something that once I'm reading it, I'm like, of course, and I'm nodding in agreement. But it's not something I gave a lot of thought to prior to this essay when I really think hard about it. What inspired you to touch on these sorts of topics that were maybe just a little... not as, they weren't the hot button topics, but they were very important.
So caregiving should be a hot button topic in this country because just a vast number of people do caregiving, whether it is professionally or in their personal lives. And caregiving is very gendered, both professionally and in terms of who does the most caregiving in a private setting. So I'm talking about like, everything from, you know, looking after children to looking after, you know, an aged parent or a sick relative or something like that. So that's unpaid caregiving. And there is a crisis in this country. Unpaid caregivers are so overlooked. They're not paid for their work at all. They're stretched completely thin. And then when we look at paid caregiving, also gendered, you know, the vast majority of personal support workers and nurses are women.
Mm-hmm.
You have nurses on one hand who have kind of been historically told to be quiet about their conditions, no matter how kind of abysmal they were, and personal support workers who have no guardrails at all, really, on their profession. They're underpaid. They often don't get sick days. They have precarious work. They can't afford to live in the cities where they work, and yet they do the most vital work, if you ask me, mm-hmm. in our society, which is looking after the vulnerable, the elderly, people who can't, for whatever reason, look after themselves. So, and it's easy to overlook because it happens all around us. So it's kind of like, you know, the air we breathe. Everywhere we look, there's caregiving. But as you say, we kind of don't notice it and we definitely don't value it. And you know, it's billions and billions of dollars worth of unpaid work that gets done constantly every day by people, and it's mostly women. And because it is gendered, it is less valued. Those two things are connected. So, I don't think we can overstate the crisis in caregiving in this country, and which is going to increase as the population gets older.
100%, yeah, that's going to be a problem that we're starting to see already. Like, it's just, you know, it's coming on, and our population is aging so rapidly, and it's such a large demographic, too. That chapter also is a great example of the intersectionality of your book. I mean, it talks about economic disparity. It talks about immigrant workers, and it talks about all these different things. So race comes into it in that regard. Obviously, you already think like this, but did it become even more important for you to express, to make sure that there was that intersectionality in all of these particular essays? Or did it just naturally come up because that is the way that you think about the world?
100% it was important to me. It was so important to me. And I would say, you know, it's only in the past maybe 15 years that I have really become aware of and tried to rectify my own kind of, you know, white feminism, which is mm-hmm. the tradition I grew up in and which can be very harmful and very toxic because it centered the voices of white women and not marginalized the voices of, you know, other women, racialized women, disabled women, mm-hmm. queer women. And when you look, for example, at the disparities in the healthcare we receive, in the wages we receive, you know, and who does the caring, it was shocking to me that right across the board, racialized women are penalized at a much higher rate than white women are. So, like, their wages are lower. As you say, they do most of the personal support workers often are migrant women mm-hmm. who, you know, come here for this reason. So I cannot overstate how important that is to me. And I made a very deliberate effort to find those stories and to make sure that my sources were diverse, the people I talked to were from different backgrounds, because that's the country we live in, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. if you don't reflect that, you're not reflecting the reality of where we live.
Absolutely not. And you do the same thing with trans and non-binary folks as well, which I think is super important, especially the more we hear about the whole TERF idea. And yeah. I mean, it's really amazing to read a book that, and not that yours is the only one, obviously, but it is amazing when you read a book that is feminist in nature and also is inclusive yeah. of that.
That was also really important to me. Mm-hmm. It makes me really kind of sad and angry when I see feminists who deny the rights of trans folk. You know, like, I don't understand it. I don't understand why we're divided against each other.
It feels like a misunderstanding of trans identity in and of itself to me.
Yes, I think it is. I think it is, and it's reactionary, and it's mm-hmm. weird, mm-hmm. because feminism should be about liberating oppressed people, and the rights of trans people, as we know, are under fire in Canada, in the United States, yeah. around the world. We're natural allies in this fight against oppression, which to me comes largely from the exploitative economic system that we live in, which benefits from patriarchy, and patriarchy benefits from, you know, the kind of extreme capitalism we're living under right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. This is a little specific, but I wanted to ask about it because I think this person is pretty cool. At the time, I don't know if anyone thought this person was super cool, but you got to sit down with Kim Campbell a couple of times.
Yes, I do think she's super cool.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. I think maybe at the time it was a little bit of my personal politics and stuff, and I was very young. But that must have been an experience to sit down with someone who is the only person, the only female-identifying person to ever have held that office in this country.
Is that not shocking?
I know,
it was 30 years
actually.
Ago. It was like for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, she was not even, her government was not even reelected. In fact, it was demolished. That is interesting because that is an example of what happens in politics,
right.
not just in this country, but mm-hmm. in the West, which is the political scientist Sylvia Beshevkin calls it imperil leadership, which is this idea that the only times, really, when women rise to the leadership of a political party is when that party is in huge trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And then, inevitably, you know, the party kind of crashes out and everybody says, oh, look at her. You know, we can't elect women. Kim Campbell is fantastic. She's so funny. She's so frank. And she has thought very, very deeply about women's role in politics. You know, she studied it as an academic after she left mm-hmm. Office. And what was interesting to me is that she said, at, like, after, you know, her government was defeated in 1993, she said she was really, she felt bad that, like, she had let women down. And then she said she would just get women coming up to her saying, thank you, and young women saying, you know, I looked up to you and I appreciated what you did. And I think even though, you know, she wasn't, her government wasn't reelected, I think that meant a lot to her, that she had been this kind of, in this vanguard, she had been this beacon. The fact that right now we don't even have a federal party that is led by a woman, except for the Green Party, I think is shocking and shameful. And we have to think about why that is.
Yeah, absolutely. And but the question is, will we, hopefully sometime, think about it?
I mean, I would hope so. Like, I, you know, I think, you know, Chrystia Freeland would be a great prime minister. But will that happen? Or, you know, there's lots of other wonderful MPs and political leaders in this country who, you know, would do a wonderful job. But we are not as progressive as we think we are. And in this country, in terms of thinking about women in leadership roles. And I cite some of the statistics around that you know, we talk the talk, but we don't walk the walk.
It's true. Absolutely true. And I mean, we shouldn't get into it because it could be another hour conversation, but even just looking at, you know, like, the Trudeau government was kind of like, it's whatever year he said it was, I can't remember now, and we got to do this. And then it kind of just stopped. Or it felt like it did. I could be wrong. I mean,
The gender balance cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. That, I mean, that seems like window dressing to me, frankly.
Yeah, exactly.
However, I will say, in his defense, he managed to bring in the daycare program, the national daycare program, which, again, has been sitting there for, like, 25 years or something, and nobody has ever managed to get it through, and Trudeau's government did. That is a very significant, that'll be a significant force for good for, you know, women in the workforce if they can get enough early childhood education workers
right.
to support it. And that means actually paying early childhood education workers who are overwhelmingly women the living wage in the cities that they, in places that they live.
Absolutely. I mean, that's obviously a crucial part of the whole thing that needs to happen. We're going to run out of time shortly, Liz, so let me quickly actually ask you one last thing about the book, and that is one of the things that I enjoy about it is the style and the personal element that's brought in. These are not academic essays, although there's plenty of information and history in here. You really do reach down inside yourself, not just what you're thinking, but what you've been through and people in your life and things like that. Is that kind of thing, for you at least, easy to weave into these essays? Is it easy to draw these connections? Or do you sometimes have to step back and give it a bit of a think and think, well, geez, I never thought about it before, but this does affect me in X and Y ways?
You have to, for me anyway, sit there as you're typing and pretend no one is ever going to read it. Like, no one is ever going to find out all this stuff about yourself. Because, you know, I became a journalist in the age when the pronoun I was considered completely verboten. It was like a swear word.
Mm-hmm.
Never put I in a story. So writing about yourself was considered kind of cheap and tawdry, which I think was a very unfair way of looking at journalism.
Yeah.
Things have changed hugely in 30 years.
Unless you went gonzo, like if you were doing like a Hunter Thompson kind of thing, right? Which was a whole different kind of vibe.
Yeah, it was considered not really journalism, but that's not true at all. You can use your personal lens as a way of, you know, spotlighting, highlighting things in the world that you think are important. And also, it's the way that readers connect to you. If you can be vulnerable with them, they will respond to it. People respond to vulnerability in writing and in storytelling more than anything else, I think. And so that is the way you connect to readers, by showing that we all share some experiences and we all feel certain pains. And I think it makes people feel seen.
Absolutely. And it connects them to the issue you're talking about, because it might be hard to for some people, they can read what you're talking about and think, I guess that's me. But it's when you actually give an example from your life that people can actually say, oh, yeah, like I relate to this person. This is a person telling me a thing, not just an article on a page. There was a person behind this, and I can relate.
I think that's so true. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, it is about time to go, so I just wanted to remind people, if they've just tuned in on the FM or if for some reason you started this MP3 in the middle, we've been talking with Elizabeth Ranzetti, and the book is called What She Said, Conversations About Equality, came out this month, October 1st, I guess it was.
Yeah.
And it's been wonderful talking to you, Liz. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Jamie.
Thanks to Liz for being our guest today. Thanks to CFMU for the studios, Afternoons in Stereo for the music, and you for listening in. My name's Jamie. You can reach me at getlitshow@gmail.com.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to CinemaScope. I am your host, Scarlett Sapia, right here on 93.3 CFMU-FM. Now, the last movie I watched, I'm sure you've heard lots of things about it, good and bad, mostly bad, but I watched Megalopolis, you know, Francis Ford Coppola's newest film. Some would say his worst. Honestly, like, okay, if you've listened to CinemaScope, you know that I have, like, pretty objectively bad taste in movies. I like terrible things. Even that, like, a few weeks ago, we did a 70s sci-fi episode, and it was all just, like, these terrible, low-budget, pulpy, campy things. And honestly, that's kind of what Megalopolis is, except it has a big budget. Don't get me wrong. It's not a great film, but it's super fun. It's a super big concept, poor execution situation. I don't think Coppola's a writer. Like, all of his think about the Godfather movies, think about Apocalypse Now. Like, all of these are based on books, and all of these are things that he did not write. This is basically Coppola taking 50 years of creative experiences and throwing them in a blender, and this is what came out. It's not great, but it's a fun time. I can promise you that. Well, I can't. Let me tell you, I go to the movie theaters almost every week with my parents. Like, I'm really close to them, as you've probably known if you listen to the show a lot. And this is the first time I've ever seen my mom, like, actually get up and walk out of a theater. She hated this film so much. So I would say probably don't spend your money on it unless you want, like, a really fun time from a guy that is just not on the same level as anyone else. Because that's exactly what Megalopolis is. But let's move on. I mentioned that, you know, all of Coppola's best movies are based on books, and that is entirely what today is about. It is movies based on books. I'll be real, when I said that last week, I was pulling it out of my butt a little bit, because, like, so many movies are based on books. What the heck did I mean by that? It is not a specific enough category to break down in 1 hour, so I'm going to narrow it down in a very self-indulgent way, but we're going to talk about movies based on books that I have read. So it's super self-indulgent, but at least I can tell you whether or not they're good adaptations or not in my heart. So let's just get right down to it. I'm sorry, I'm rambling. Let's start with one of the most obvious, because we are going to get pretty specific going in. But let's talk about Harry Potter for a second. Now, I'm not here to talk about J.K. Rowling, for the record. She's a pretty awful person. We don't like her here on CinemaScope. But Harry Potter is a cultural touchstone at this point, and it means a lot to a lot of people. And a lot of people were involved in creating the films, at least, than just her. So there's no reason to, you know, take down the entire institution when it's just one bad apple. I will say also, I'm sure you've heard about it, Maggie Smith did pass away recently. So this is very unfortunate timing, and we did lose a treasure. Anyway, let's talk about Harry Potter. obviously a super big movie for some stuff coming up. It started this whole YA book to movie push. And like, I know I'm a Gen Z girl, but I promise we're only going to be talking about like one other than this one. For the film itself, though, they saw Daniel Radcliffe in David Copperfield a few years before when they were casting the film.